being as popular as he is, being a celebrity that he is, all the stuff he does, he took time for us. I mean, this guy is one of the busiest people I know. Whenever I see him, he's always got a stack of papers and he's writing music and he's doing everything and he's helping run the business. You know, he's managing a band, he's doing all these things, but he still has time to, you know, connect with people. And he still has time to try to pull somebody up and give them experience they might not have, or to educate or teach somebody, you know. And that says a lot, man. There's no one that plays like him, you know, and does the thing he does, that he does, and yet he still finds time. People do half of what he does and say they don't have time for people.
Hi, I'm Leah Roseman, and this is my podcast, Conversations with Musicians. I hope the series inspires you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. DeWitt Fleming Jr. is a multi-talented and brilliant performer renowned for his tap dancing, choreography, and acting, and is also a singer and drummer. As he said to me in this interview, when I'm tap dancing, I'm drumming. You'll hear about his experience growing up in the projects, the importance of attending an arts high school, the usefulness of theater training for musicians, and insights into memorization, mindset, and performing. He shared his experiences working with Wynton Marsalis, meeting his wife, the actor and singer Jenny Harney Fleming, with whom he's presently performing A Wonderful World, the Louis Armstrong musical, his experiences with Cirque du Soleil, and touring internationally with Riverdance, and most recently playing both drums and performing tap with the Hot Sardines in Tokyo. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. You can support this independent podcast through both my merchandise with a unique design from artist Steffi Kelly, as well as through my Ko-fi page. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Cold, and you can use the timestamps to navigate the episode. This weekly podcast is in season 4, and I sent out an email newsletter where you can get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Have a look at the description of this episode where you'll find all the links.
Hey, DeWitt, thanks so much for joining me tonight.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We just had some technical problems, and I know you've had a very long day of rehearsals for your new show, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Of course.
I first saw your dancing and your drumming when I was researching J. Walter Hawks, and I saw some work you'd done with the Hot Sardines. I brought you up when I was speaking with him because I'd never seen that before. You know, someone tap dancing to jazz.
Yeah.
But a long history of dancing and jazz in that way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, jazz has been around for a long time, and tap dance has been around for a longer time. You know, tap dance was the keeper of the rhythm, you know, like the drum.
Yeah.
And that swing rhythm, that 6/8 feel that we know that really cultivated jazz music, the tap dancers were doing it and keeping that time, keeping that culture alive, keeping that tradition alive. So the dancers really helped to keep that the music alive to be able to create all the music that we have in here today. So it kind of starts with the dancers, really.
So actually, going back to slavery, the slaves weren't permitted to have drums, right?
Yes. This is correct. However, that wasn't the start of creating rhythms, you know, with the feet and rhythmic dancing. That was something that helped us to preserve things while we were here. But the idea of rhythmic dancing goes back way, 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 way before any settlers ever came to America. That's a common misconception that tap dance, as we know it today, is an art form that was formed and created here in the United States 100%. But the roots and the idea of dancing rhythmically with one's feet is something that goes back a long, long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, in many cultures too.
I mean the root of it is definitely African. And I've had this conversation so many times, and I love it because we as Americans unfortunately sometimes believe that everything that the rest of the world didn't communicate with each other, didn't trade with each other, didn't have relationships with each other, didn't trade cultures with each other, like we do in the States. We feel like a lot of times that that started with us, or that we were kind of around the same time when, this started happening. But you got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of Africa trading with Ireland, of Africa trading with Europe in general, Portugal. Spain, it was a group of people called the Berbers. If you look at their history, they're responsible for taking culture, goods, music, all types of things, religion, and spreading it all throughout the Middle East and Europe. And they are a lot of, I think, have a lot to do with a lot of African cultures being spread throughout the world. You look at that area of the world right there where you have Northern Africa, Spain, India, Portugal, and you start to see a lot of similarities. They were all trading with each other, culture, goods. They were all, for, exchanging. And then the cool thing about it is that you got Ireland, which is a little further north, but it's a straight line. The west coast of Ireland is straight line down from what northern West Africa, Portugal. And there's a Celtic town, a place called Galicia that used to be in Portugal, which goes back a long, long time as well. So you what we know from that is that the trading was happening, the culture was happening. Even when you go to Ireland and you talk about, you go to Galway, they have a very rich tradition there, called Seanú dance, which predates Irish dancing. And if you look at it looks a lot like tap dancing. And if you talk to Seanú dancers and some of the historians, they talk about when the Africans and the Spaniards would come over to the west coast of Ireland. And they did that because of they were, of course, it was the quickest route, but also you had the English who were feuding with everybody were on the east side, the east coast of Ireland in places like Dublin. And so it's no wonder that you got Spaniards, the Africans, the Portuguese all going to the West, and you have so much rich culture there. So I say all that to say, we as humans have been trading and creating with each other for a long, long, long time.
Yeah, that's super interesting about the dance history, which I didn't know about. I mean, I've talked to people on this podcast from, well, all kinds of places, and it's really interesting to see the evolution of instruments and also rhythms, through Bulgaria and Iran and all these things. I always find it so fascinating. But let's go back. Let's go to more recent history. I saw a little bit of a clip of your one man show, Hoofin' Out of the Hood, which and in which do you want to talk to us about that?
Absolutely. So that came about that there's a woman, her name is Yvonne Seegers. I call her my aunt because there's a good buddy of mine who I call my brother. We grew up together in DC. And when I graduated from Marymount Manhattan College, I was, doing the performer hustle, getting gigs and running around, doing whatever to pay the bills. And I was at her house and she said, "You need a job." And I said, "Yeah, I'm gigging." And she said, "No, you need a job that you could pay your bills and focus on your art and not stop all this running around." And I said, "Okay." At the time, she was the public defender for for New Jersey. And she said, "Why don't you come work as a secretary? I'll train you, and then in about 6 months to a year, you'll be one of my criminal investigators." And I said, "Okay." So I preface that story just to there's more to that story, but I preface that story to talk about the relationship that we had. Fast forward, she's working at a professor at Kane University teaching law. And she said, "We have this program where we have Miss Seegers was a became a professor at Kane University teaching law, and she had some students who were from similar backgrounds as me. And so she wanted me to come and talk to them about my story. And she said, "Can you give an hour and a half presentation?" And so initially I thought, well, there's nothing special about my story. My buddy who's on it was, he said to me, "You don't realize what you've done and where you come from and how inspiring that is." And it's funny because when you're in it, when you're doing it and you're just going and it's just something that you have to do and you just go, you don't really reflect on what you've done, even sometimes where you came from or what you've been able to accomplish. You are there's so much more to be done that you really feel like you haven't done what you really need to do yet. And so when he told me, I guess even to him how it was inspiring, I had to sit back and I just thought about from when I left DC as Washington, DC as a teenager to when I moved to New York up to then, all the things that I've done, I kind of started to see what he and his aunt were talking about. And so I just started writing down my story. I started writing down the neighborhood I grew up in, things that I've went through in that neighborhood, how important it was to me to go to an arts high school, how it saved my life. Once I went to arts high school, then I went to college in New York, and how I just never looked back. And that's kind of where that show came from. And it was recorded, and so I took it and I said, "Well, if." I mean, some kids came up crying afterwards because they had connected with me as far as being in a position where it was something they loved to do, but they were afraid to let others see them do it, something they wanted to do, and just being able to be themselves in an environment where no one looks like them, no one looks like you, no one talks like you, dresses like you, being afraid to be yourself. And so when I heard back from the students and they would talk to me afterwards, I decided this is something that maybe I should try to do again to maybe inspire other people to be themselves, be brave, and know that there is a place for them, no matter who they are, where they come from.
And but in the show you do now, you incorporate dance and music with your story.
Yeah. And I just talk about my journey from learning drums. The gentleman named Brother Ah, who taught me drums, how that propelled me to something, to playing in the jazz band and the concert band. I talk about people that I met in junior high school and how our perception of people sometimes is a reflection of the things we're afraid to do, and how as as I got older, I became really good friends with, a person that I didn't like, so-called didn't like. And it was mainly because they were being themselves 100% of the time. And I didn't know how to do that. And I labeled them as annoying or, crazy too much or whatever, not realizing that, I was afraid to do what they were doing. And so I felt I had to diminish that or put them down for it. And that connected with them because that's something that happens at that age, those teenage years and those college years. We're still trying to figure ourselves out and figure out how to be ourselves. And those that have figured out, something's wrong with them. That's the culture of that age. And so that's part of the story. I talk about overcoming growing up the projects and the things you have to do to get out of that, and understand that the projects is not one thing. I talk about how the majority of people in the project that I knew were good working people. And that, we think that we're something, we're always told we're something that most of the times we're not. That, of course, every place has its bad parts. I don't care if it's projects, I don't care if it's suburbia, I don't care if it's anywhere. There's always going to be a percentage of people that are bad, or not positive or good or doing the right thing. And so it's the only place where it defines that culture or people is in the Black communities and in the projects. And it's not the truth. Some of the most hardworking, honest people I grew up with, they didn't have much. But, people think of the project, they think everybody's a drug dealer, everybody steals, everybody's, a criminal. And that's not the truth. So I talked to them about that, about dealing with that, and how do you move through the world, not allowing that to affect you and hold you back from what you want to do. So it goes into a lot of different things. But it's those some of the things that I think really hit home with a lot of people, the young people especially.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk. Your wife is a well-known Broadway star, Jenny Harney Fleming, and you met on the set of Pearl, right?
Yes, there was a musical called Pearl Bailey. It was written by Charles Murray, C.B. Murray. And it was directed by Jenny's father, a Tony Award winning Ben Harney. And the wardrobe was done by her mother, Olive Harney. The stage manager was her sister, Amaris Harney. And her niece and nephews were the stage hands and stage managers. So, I walked into a situation where I was surrounded by her family. And so I never, going into the situation, even before I knew that, I never had any idea of us, dating or anything like that. It's just something that kind of happened later. And we didn't start dating until after the show, but we really got to know each other on that show.
And she was in Hamilton for 7 years, right?
She just left so we can do this new show together, A Wonderful World.
Okay. And meanwhile, you have a couple of small children.
Yes, we have a 4-year-old and a soon-to-be 3-year-old in November.
I ask because my husband and I brought up a couple of girls, and I know it's very hard when you're in the performing arts and you have small children. I mean, your schedule alone it's hard.
It is hard. It is hard. Thankfully, we found some really good babysitters, and they love them. They've been with us for a couple years, You just make sure you find the time, and that's the most important part. It, as a performer, you're a business person. You're your own manager. You're your own PR person. You're everything. And so it's easy to slip into whenever I have free time, there's something that you have to do for your career. Like you said, it's really hard to make sure that you shut everything off and just spend time with your kids, because easily you can jump on your phone and answer an email or return a text or do whatever, instead of just, nope, I'm gonna sit here and we're gonna talk and play, So we're very adamant about making sure we do that. Thankfully, the girls understand so far that sometimes mommy and daddy aren't home, but we know that that will change as they change often. So we're just trying to be prepared for it as much as we can.
Yeah. It's almost easier before they're in school, I think, as performers, because you're working at night, so sometimes you can spend time with them in the day, depending on your schedule, right?
Yeah, well, they're in preschool now, so
Yeah.
but we get the mornings. We get the mornings, and we haven't started our shows yet. So thankfully, we still have our evenings, but we're trying to figure that out, what we're going to do once we have our shows. Since our schedule will be set, we're trying to figure out how to make sure we have those set times as a family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but you don't take it for granted, right? There's that too.
No. Yeah. You can't take anything for granted. You have to appreciate and really dive in and really, take everything that you have in front of you and appreciate it as much as you can.
Yeah. Now, the show you're doing is a tribute to Louis Armstrong.
Yes. Yes, the show is it's about Louis Armstrong. It's about his life, and it actually shines light on his four wives that most people don't know about, and how they were very integral parts to his life. And they actually kind of frame the different pivotal and very important parts of his life as a person and as a musician and his career. So it's really interesting how each wife, they have a chapter, and that chapter is a chapter of his life that is all four are very different. The wives are very different, but also the chapters of his life were very different because of where he was in his career, where he was trying to go. And it's very cool and interesting to see how those wives really affected those chapters in his life and actually propelled him to be the man and the musician that he was.
Oh, sounds really interesting. I'm curious, DeWitt, in your role as a choreographer, I imagine most of the time you're working with expert dancers, but have you been placed in a situation where they weren't professional dancers and you had to get them to look good?
Oh man, it's so funny because we were just talking about this. Everyone thinks that when you get to a certain level, everything is easier and you have everything you want at your
Yeah.
fingertips, and it is not the case. I'm about to quote Biggie, "More money, more problems." So there's more money in Broadway, but there's more issues, because whenever you have more money, there's more, the stakes are higher, and there are more people that you have to please and more people that have a say and more people that want things. I say that to say the compromises are bigger. I was lucky enough this time to get about four good tap dancers that have pretty good feet. But when we first started, I was told I would only get two. And you might say, well, how does that work? Well, these same dancers have to be able to act. You have to be able to sing. and they have to do these things at a high level, and they also have to do the other styles of dance that are in the show. And so everything is always a compromise, trying to get the best people that are going to be able to do the job. So there are always times where people are not at the level that you would like your dance to be. And that's where your how good you are at your job, the artistry, and how do you still convey the message? How do you put up excellent work, not only entertain your audience, but educate your audience with whoever is given to you. And everyone has to look just about the same. It's easier when you have willing people that are willing and people that are passionate about what they do. And I am very adamant about I can make anybody look good with tap dancing. And I could teach anybody how to tap in 5 minutes. I say that all the time because it is culture, it's in us, it's a cultural thing. And Buster Brown used to say, if you could tap dance, you can walk. I mean, if you can walk, you could tap dance. And it's true. It's very true. So yeah, I mean, it happens, but you have to be really strong and adamant and really have a passion for what you do, and a passion for people and trying to understand people and encourage and inspire them, and things become easier. Once you take that pressure off, thinking it has something to do with you, once you look at the bigger picture of things, things become a lot easier.
I'm curious, you went to college for acting. How did that training help you as a dancer and a musician?
Ah, oh, I am so thankful that I trained as an actor first and not a dancer or a musician. And the reason why I say that is because actors have to research and look and have to fit in a bigger picture, and they have to understand how to put together a story. And you have to understand the human condition. You have to understand psychology. You have to understand intention. You have to be a good listener. All these things are just, have really helped me, especially as a musician, especially as a dancer, because you're not really taught those things all the time, especially as a dancer. As a dancer, a lot of times you're taught to imitate, to do what you're being shown. You're taught maybe a certain colors, your certain feelings. But I don't see a lot of dance. So yeah, I'm so thankful that I studied acting first, because it gives you it really grounds you into finding the truth, and understanding human beings in order to be able to connect with them better. And that's that's so important in all the arts, but I don't think all the arts get equal training in that.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I was thinking,
Yeah.
I didn't talk to you before, but I really always like to share music if I can as part of these episodes since
Yeah.
it's about musicians. You put out a great album in 2020, Sax and Taps with Erica von
Oh, thanks.
Kleist.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a couple of video clips from on YouTube. I was thinking maybe we could use Doxy because for those people
Sure.
watching, they could see a little bit, and then those people listening will hear how you integrate the tap with the sax.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're about to hear a clip from Doxy highlighting DeWitt's tap dancing with saxophonist Erica von Kleist. Sax and Taps album Intersplosion is linked in the show notes of this podcast, along with this video, which was recorded live at the Red Room in 2017.
Thank you.
Just a quick break from the episode. You may also be interested in my episodes with J. Walter Hawks, Van Black, Mike Asudri, Destiny Muhammad, Emily Sankofa, Kelly Lee Evans, and so many others. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project costs me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support this series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, phone cases, notebooks, water bottles, and more. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Please check out my back catalog with weekly episodes going back to 2021. Now back to DeWitt Fleming Jr.
I don't know if there's other things you want to share to show your drumming. I mean, there's like amazing, like 1 minute clip you put up of you just with the bucket. It's just phenomenal.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, you know, I got to put up more drumming stuff. I mean, I was really blessed with the opportunity to go to Tokyo in December with the High Sardines and play drums. And we did about a week worth of shows at Blue Note in Tokyo. And it was probably one of the most stressful things I've ever done, because I was going back and forth between drums and tap. Again, coming from the theater training, you know, you want to keep the audience their attention. And you never want to drop that attention. You want to keep that thread going and keep them engaged the entire time. So I was stressed about how to transition from the drums to tap without you know, taking them out of the experience. And so it was very stressful. And also just making sure that I was at the top of my game on the drums. Tap I knew I had, you know, in the drums, but I wanted to just make sure I was as the best as I could be, because I'm playing with some great musicians. And so I was really shedding and training and going over the music and making sure, you know, that's the last thing I want, is for them also to have a bad experience because I wasn't on top of my game, you know. So it was a little stressful, but we did it and we had a good gig.
What did you think of Japan? Was it your first time there?
First time. Yes. First time. I loved it. I want to go back. I mean, it was just amazing. Just, yeah, I can't say enough about Japan. I really loved it.
Are there specific memories about the trip or anything?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing, because my wife went with me, Jenny went with me, and the first thing, we were like, so quiet. I mean, imagine New York with all the people, the same crowds, everything, but it was quiet. Nobody's honking their horn all crazy. You're in the subways and it's packed. Nobody's yelling, you know, nobody's talking loud on their phone. And that was one of the first things we noticed. We were like, this is surreal. You know, everybody's just going about their business in a peaceful way. The food, of course, was amazing. Different museums. We went to some museums. Yeah, Japan was great. The people, the culture, like I said, just how things in their society, you can tell they really took time to really figure out what would help people's lives be better. And that I thought that was really cool.
I'm going there on tour in May for the first time, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, you're gonna love it. You're
Yeah.
gonna love it. Yeah.
Now you've been on tour with Cirque du Soleil, was one of your gigs.
Yep. Yes. Yes. Man, that was crazy. So, my buddy and I, Jared Grimes, about 2003, I had just graduated college, and we had started this show called Broadway Underground with Cheryl Cutlett. And Cheryl approached Jared because he had done some workshops for her project dance. And she said, "Well, I have access to this space. You know, we should do a show." And so Jared came to me and we created this idea called Broadway Underground. And the whole idea was to give a platform for performers. It was something that we did at Marymount, with something called the Soldiers of Hip Hop, started by this girl named Michelle Seabreeze. And we started that because it was a small community of people of color at Marymount. And we, at that time, colorblind casting and all that stuff wasn't, really a big thing back then. So a lot of the shows we didn't have access to. And so we didn't get to perform as much as we would like to, or some of us didn't get to perform at all. So Shelly created this program called the Soldiers of Hip Hop. To give the people of color in the school a platform to perform on, whether it be dance, spoken word, hip hop, singing, whatever. And so Jared and I were really inspired by that, and we wanted to do it our way, which was hosting, and we loved doing comedy and little skits and things like that. And we wanted to figure out how to make it the same thing without it being just like a variety show. And so we came up with our own way of everything had a theme. So like a little mini musical, if you will. We had singers, dancers. And then David Schiner from comedian, actor, famous a clown, came to see our show with Bill Irwin. And they were really excited about the show. And so they went and told Cirque about it because they were working with Cirque a lot at the time. David Shiner told Cirque, "Hey, I want to create a show based around this energy and what this is, but I want to do it in a circus clown way." And so fast forward, 2008 or something like that, they approached Jared about it because Jared did all the choreography in the show. And so they said, "Jared, we want you to come and choreograph and try to help us recreate, what y'all do here at Broadway Underground." And so that's kind of how that came about. Jared was the choreographer. I performed in the show. We went up to Montreal for like 4 or 5 months and built the show with David Shiner. Bill Irwin would come in and help and, do some things. Unfortunately, the show didn't go too well because that was their first attempt to do theater, a proscenium style show. And Cirque was so big at the time that unfortunately they weren't willing to take advice from people who weren't as big as they were. I'll put it that way. So, unfortunately, the New York market and New York theater scene is very smart, and there's a culture there, and if you try to come in and not respect the culture, or even try to embrace the culture, you're not going to do too well. And I think that's anywhere, whenever you go into someone else's, home, you want to kind of see how they do things first, get comfortable with that, and then try to push the envelope. You can't just come in and just start doing your own thing. So I say all that to say, the show didn't work too well, and I think that's why.
Well, that must have been
But it was a
disappointing.
great experience. We had fun.
Yeah.
It was, but we all knew it because we kept trying to. They did the right thing by getting all musical theater and theater people, but they didn't listen to us.
Yeah.
And we kept telling them, "You can't do that. That's not how theater works," And they were like, "We've been doing this," and we would say, "Okay, all right. You're spending all this money. Okay, you got it. You're right." And so, unfortunately, it just didn't read. It didn't read the way they wanted it to, because proscenium and theater shows are different from circus shows. There's certain things and certain ways you do stuff to engage your audience. It's not the same. That's I think ultimately I think that's why that show failed. But for us, it was a great experience. Really was a great experience.
Yeah. I mean, we always learn from everything, right? Even when it's maybe the
Oh,
failure is even
absolutely.
more. Yeah.
Oh,
Well,
absolutely.
yeah.
Yeah.
When I was looking at all your projects, it was overwhelming. There's things I was going to ask you about, but are there experiences maybe you want to highlight that have been special memories or where you really got to learn a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my favorite memory, and I tell everybody, anytime anybody asks me, it's always Wynton Marsalis.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say that is because the first book my mom got me when I joined Jazz Band was Jazz for Young People by Wynton Marsalis. And so, he immediately came like this figure in my mind. And then moving to New York and finally getting to meet him, and the way I met him, which was a very humbling experience. We went to go see a show with my same buddy Jarrett. We snuck backstage. We saw him coming down the hallway. We said, "Hey, we're tap dancers." He said, "Show me what you got." We started dancing. He pulled out his horn, started jamming backstage with him.
No way.
And the rest is, yeah. The rest is history. I mean, after that, he said, "Take my number." I took his number. Talked to him about 2 weeks later, told us to come over to rehearsal, bring your shoes. We're on Rose Hall, the stage of Rose Hall, jamming with the band. And he said, "Cool, I think we'll do that in tonight's show." And just like that, I was on stage at Rose Hall, thousands of people with Wynton Marsalis and the orchestra, So, I mean, it's an amazing story for me because it just shows the humanity that he has and the excellence. It's like, being as popular as he is, being a celebrity that he is, all the stuff he does, he took time for us, I mean, this guy is one of the busiest people I know. Whenever I see him, he's always got a stack of papers and he's writing music, he's writing orchestras, he's writing symphonies, and he's doing everything, and he's helping run the business, he's managing a band, he's doing all these things, but he still has time to, connect with people, and he still has time to try to pull somebody up and give them experience they might not have, or to educate or teach somebody, and that says a lot, man. There's no one that plays like him, and does the thing he does that he does, and yet he still finds time. People do half of what he does and say they don't have time for people or to connect with people or to be social or humanity. And this guy is always busy. It's not a minute of his day, but he still finds time to connect with people. And that's something so powerful that has always stuck with me.
And you guys had the confidence to, and I'm sure you approached him the right way. You know, you probably just had the right
Yeah.
way of talking to him without
You know,
whatnot.
yeah. Well, yeah, because you know, we were kind of lucky too, because we didn't know that with his connection with Juilliard, he was they if you look like a student, they would let you backstage. They would assume that you were from Juilliard. You know, now things have changed now because that was a long time ago. But they assumed that we were Juilliard students. So when we went to the stage door and said we want to go backstage, they just let us in. You know, and we're so naive, you know, we're just thinking, oh, all right, we're cool. You know, not realizing the whole, you know, situation. And when we saw him, you know, we were just so excited about the concert he just did. It was amazing. And so, you know, we were just like, wow, that was amazing. You know, nice to meet you. You know, we're tap dancers. We love jazz, you know. And then he just said, show me what you got, you
Okay.
know. But I mean, that's how he was, you know. If you say hi to him, he's walking up to you. You know, he's not standing there waiting for you to come to him. You say hi, he's walking up to you. I mean, he's that's just how he was. He makes everybody feel comfortable, you know.
So there's a
Yeah.
video on YouTube of you dancing at Lincoln Center with Wynton Marsalis Band. Is it from that performance or is it a different one?
No, that performance, I don't think that was taped. The before it was it's only t
This is
it
more
might be a
recent.
couple of I don't. Oh, so no. So that was the second time we did that concert. And that concert was the one that he did with Animals. And we were sitting in his apartment and he's going through this music. And he said, and he goes, man, I've been wanting to do this concert. And I wrote this whole concert, I wrote this whole movement of music for Savion. But then he disappeared on me. And so he said, I created this years ago. It's been sitting here. I want to do this music. And so he said, I want to play it for y'all. And then he played it for us. And he was like, y'all think y'all could do this? And this one's called Frog. You know, this one's called Chicken. And then this one's called, yeah, I can't remember the other ones, but it was a movement with different animals. And he said, now this music's tricky now. And we said, well, just play it, you know. And so he played it. And we were like, yeah, we could do something. So he said, all right, well, look, I'm gonna send it to y'all. We're gonna get in the studio and let's make something. Let's do this. Cause I've been wanting to do this music. And I said, all right, cool, let's do it. Me and Jared, we go in, we rehearse some things, put some things together. And it was the original one was just me, Jared, and Wynton in the orchestra. And we went through from animal to animal, and he talked in between like he does, you know, to educate and tell, give people the reference of everything. And he was saying how instruments, the whole thing was how instruments really mimic sounds of animals and of nature, and how they move and how they speak and the different tones and pitches and things that they do. And that was the concert, but that was a long time ago. So the one you're talking about that you saw was, I think, the third time that concert was done. And that was maybe about 6 years, 7 years ago, or something like that. 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, what I'll do to it,
Yeah.
I'll share that link in the show notes to that video on YouTube and people can click on it because it's great. It's like
Okay, cool.
you're right across the stage and it's great
Yeah.
footage.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And when I saw that, I was also thinking, you know, tap dancers often you're on a box or like this is there's a tradition of that. And
Yeah.
depending on the context, and actually, like during the
Yeah.
pandemic, even you filmed some stuff in your apartment. Like, here I am doing my thing in this
Yeah.
tiny space, but you can create so much
Yeah.
texture and shape. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's years and years of messing around and trying to express yourself, you know. But also, I got to give a shout out to Capizio. That they you know, they sponsored me with the tap shoes, And the reason why is because I've tried a bunch of different shoes. There's no shoe that I know that gives the tone, the different tones and options of tones that Capizio does. So I really got to really give it to them, you know. It's like a fine-tuned drum. Because I've tried other shoes, and it's just the different textures and tones I can get with those shoes, you know. It really gives you a nice surface to really be able to play with and try different things. But it takes a lot of technique, a lot of years. Not easy, you know. People say, "Oh, I want some shoes like that." And I give it to them, and they be like, "It don't sound the same." I say, "Well, you know, doing this a long time."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the teaching and mentoring you do? I know you do workshops. I'm not sure how regularly you work with younger people.
Yeah, I whenever I get a chance, I'm always connecting with different organizations and different places because you know, that's why I'm here. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people coming to share their experiences, share their art. So whenever I hear of anybody do anything or organization, I just reach out and say, "Hey, I'm available. Let's work something out. You know, I would love to come and talk to the kids or teach." You know, and I started teaching my first year in college. Is when my school, Duke Ellington School of the Arts down in DC, asked me to come back and teach their summer program. And so I started going back teaching acting and tap dancing. And then you know, just kind of it just kind of I just kind of kept it up. Yeah, I think it's just so important to give back, share with others, and theater really helps you to understand how important it is to be a servant and serve your community. And being able to teach and give insight is a great way to do that. And it really shows also that the theater shows the importance of just your presence, just you being who you are, doing what you're doing. How that in itself inspires people, and you don't realize it until somebody comes up to you after the show and says something to you. And I used to work with New Jersey Tap Dance Ensemble, and Miss Deborah Mitchell, who founded it and artistic director, before we would go on every show, she would always say, "There's one person that you're about to change their life, you know, their lives or their life." And she said, you know, don't take that for granted. So you got to go out there and do the best, you know, and do the best for them, you know, because for me, that one person was me. You know, there was a show or shows that did that for me. So I always hear that in the back of my head whenever I perform or do something, because it is, it's true. It's true. You really do change lives. Yeah.
And that must help when you're doing things like a Broadway show so many times, the same show.
Yeah, absolutely, it does, you know. But theater is alive, you know. It's moving, it's changing, it's ever evolving. You know, we're humans, so there's no way we could feel the same way today that we're going to feel tomorrow, the day after. And so once you know that, it's exciting to be able to find the new things that are going to happen that day. And like you said, when there is something that maybe, you know, when you need that extra kick or push to get through the day, knowing that there's somebody out there or a few people out there who, you know, this is really going to change their life. You know, it definitely does inspire you, it pushes you, and it lets you, it reminds you that you're there for a service. You know, you're serving a community, you're serving a people. It's you know, it's not about you. And when it becomes about you, you gotta go. You gotta quit. Because something ain't right.
I was thinking about the connection between, dance, theater, and music, which we talked about, in terms of two things. Like, one is improvisation, because you came out of it as a drummer, jazz drummer, huge. It's like all about that. That must help you as an actor.
It does. It does. I mean, it's rhythm, like I say, everything is rhythm. If you're able to find that rhythm, then it's really you're really gonna be successful at what you do. I can't think of any one thing that doesn't have a rhythm to it. And that's why people say, oh, I got in a rhythm. It's energy. You find that right a stream of energy becomes a rhythm. And so that has definitely helped help with theater and everything, Life is music.
And the other thing I was thinking about was memorization. So I'm always amazed with actors how they can memorize all these lines. And then, as a dancer, like the sequence, like it's all kind of related but different, right?
So, I tell people what, and I always tell when I'm teaching acting, if you know your intentions and you know what you want, the lines become like second nature, right? So, for example, I can have 2 or 3 pages about, and to the untrained eye, it looks like, they're not talking about anything, But once you read that scene, you say, oh, okay. So I want them to agree with me, agree with my idea. And they're not agreeing with my idea right now. And I realize that I'm not explaining it properly. Right? So if that's the scene, the lines become easy. Because I already know what my intentions are, what I'm trying to do, what I want from the other person. So when I say, so are you going to go do this thing with me? And they say no. And I say, why? And they say, well, I don't want to. Then I, oh, well, why did, they don't want to? Okay, let me explain it again. So it just makes sense. Once why you're doing what you're doing, it just makes sense. It's like, oh, I would say that. Or I could see why they would say that. So then the memorization is not so rigid. It's not mathematical necessarily, It's more it's more like a rhythm. It's more something that's natural that makes sense to you. So and you're listening and you're responding because we do it all the time. Again, theater where we're recreating human experiences. So once you understand what that experience is, you can relate to it, the lines become easy because you probably said it before yourself.
There's another show you were involved with that might be interesting to reflect on was Riverdance.
Oh yeah. Good old River Dance. I am so thankful for River Dance because I've traveled all over the world with River Dance. I mean, I've been to about 30 something countries,
Wow.
and a lot of those countries are because of River Dance. Yeah, that was the first time I toured. No, that's a lie. That was the first time I toured for an extended period of time, away from home, overseas. So that is not a lie. Overseas with a multicultural company. And so what that does to you, being in other countries with a lot of different people that speak different languages and going from country to country to country to country, you're constantly learning. You're constantly adapting. You're constantly just listening, experiencing, and I thought it was wonderful because, the Irish have their own way of saying things and talking and their own culture of how they do things. And you got the English dancers, they have their own culture and how they talk and what they think. And then you got the Russian dancers And you know, and within the Russian dance troupe, sometimes you got Georgian dancers, sometimes you got Ukrainian dancers, sometimes you have Romanians, you know, so that could be a mixed podge too. And then you got your Spanish dancer, right? And then you got the band, and then you got your Australian dancers, you know. So it's just a, it was so cool to be in this environment and have conversations about things, you know, and all of us be on different pages, but figure out, but through the conversation, be able to understand each other and essentially live together on the road, you know. I thought it was beautiful. And then within that, you're in China, you know, you know, in Germany. You're in, you know, Norway or whatever. And so now you got to learn that culture and language and figure out how that stuff works too. So I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was cool. I love the show. It's just so much fun. The music is great. The dancers are great. Yeah, it was a great experience. You know, I really loved it. I really did.
And you
Yeah.
also went on tour with Alicia Keys.
No, I
No?
don't know who said that. No. Somebody said that and then everybody's running with it. You know, everybody's like, oh, you want a tour? It's like, no, I did not. Oh, let me plug this in for this guy. So I performed with Alicia Keys at the Apollo in New York City. Someone reached out to me, I can't remember who it was, and they said Alicia Keys wants to do a kind of 20s, 30s, you know, speakeasy style show. And so they said, well, can you and another dance, can you create a dance with a Nicholas Brothers style dance with another dancer? And I said, well, yeah, sure, no problem. So I ended up choreographing for something, Brian Davis, Mr. Taptastic. I ended up choreographing, calling him and choreographing something for her and her show, the opening of her show. And then we got there, and it was almost the complete opposite. So it was like the night before the show, and we're at the Apollo in the audience trying to recreate this dance because they wanted, it was a miscommunication. They wanted a speakeasy style show, but they wanted the dancers. The only thing about the Nicholas Brothers they wanted with the dancers is that there was two guys. They just wanted two guys to dance, but they wanted it more modern. They wanted us to, you know, have the tucks and tails and all that stuff like the Nicholas Brothers, but they wanted it to be more modern and into what her music was. So that was interesting because I got there, had my whole routine, this is what we're going to do. And it was like, no, we was thinking more. And I was like, okay, all right, here we go. Give us like 30 minutes, we'll be back. And then we go in the audience and make something up. You know, I choreographed something else, put it together. You know, the band, I said, can you play that again? They played the thing. Okay, cool. All right, we'll be back. You know, and then we did the show. So it was fun. And she was great. She was amazing.
Okay,
Yeah.
that's really cool. So,
Yeah.
I do. I'm mindful of your time, and it's getting late, so we'll close this out. I'm just
Yeah.
wondering to reflect on, I don't know, like, do you feel like there's enough music in your life just because of dance, or if you could have the perfect balance, would you be playing more?
Yes. The short answer is yes. There's so much I want to do. You know, it's I'm learning to really just be invested in what I'm doing at the moment. Because if not, I'll be going off in all different types of directions, which I still do, but I try to zero in. But yeah, I always want to play more. I mean, right over here, you know, you can't see it, but I got my electronic drum set up. I had my acoustic drums, and my wife said, You gotta stop playing. So I got my electronic drum set, but I love music. I love music. And it's a part of my everyday life. And I would love to be playing drums more. But I also know that when I'm tap dancing, I'm drumming. I'm keeping time. You know, that's where my style comes from, is playing drums, keeping time. And also what I love too, you know, about tap dancing is that, you know, like drums though, you don't need a drum, you don't need sticks. Tap dance, you don't need tap shoes. Wherever I go, I can dance, get out some rhythms I might have in my head. Same thing, I can drum on my legs. So the instruments are an extension of your vocabulary and your expression. But your expression starts with your body, you know. So although I would like to more, I know that that doesn't limit me, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, super inspiring meeting you today. Thanks so much for this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. This was great.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. Or you can browse the collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly, with notebooks, mugs, shirts, phone cases, and more. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. Have a wonderful week.